If you weren't with us on Wednesday evening, it was my turn to teach on Wednesday night, and with it being my turn to speak this morning, I thought we would talk about something somewhat related to the topic on Wednesday night. So on Wednesday night, we have been going through lists of five, and my assignment was the five most significant events in the Bible involving angels. And unlike some of the other Wednesday night classes, I thought it'd be good for just us to kind of see how many of those stories we could remember. And we ended up coming up with about 60, 65 stories involving angels in the Bible. And we grouped some things together. The actual number is certainly a lot higher than that. But in the end, after going through all of those stories, we decided on the five most significant stories involving angels would be the creation, the giving of the old law, the birth of Jesus, the death and resurrection of Jesus, kind of a combination there, and then the fifth was the return of Jesus. This morning, I want to talk about two stories that were not in those top five, but I think are important for us to learn from. We're going to primarily talk about one, but there's another story of an angel that helps to support some of the things I'd like to say in referencing the first story. So if you'd like to follow along, we're going to read from 2 Kings chapter 6. And this was one of the stories that I almost didn't include in the list because it doesn't specifically say that there were angels involved. There were certainly heavenly hosts involved. Whether or not the thing that we are going to read about are angels, I think they are, but there may be some that disagree with that. And actually, the point that there's angels in the story is not the point that we're going to spend the most time on. So, in 1 Kings chapter 6, we're going to begin in verse 8, and we'll all read through verse 23 for us. 1 Kings chapter 6, beginning in verse 8. Now the king of Syria was making war against Israel, and he consulted with his servants, saying, "My camp will be in such and such a place." And the man of God sent to the king of Israel, saying, "Beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are coming down there." So the king of Israel sent someone to the place of which the man of God had told him. Thus he warned him, and he was watchful there, not just once or twice. Therefore the heart of the king of Syria was greatly troubled by this thing. He called his servants and said to them, "Will you not show me which of you is for the king of Israel?" And one of his servants said, "None, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom." So he said, "Go and see where he is, that I may send and get him." And it was told him, saying, "Surely he is in Dothan." Therefore he sent horses and chariots and a great army there, and they came by night and surrounded the city. And when the servant of the man of God arose early and went out, there was an army surrounding the hills with horses and chariots. And his servant said to him, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" So he answered, "Do not fear, those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And Elisha prayed and said, "Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see." And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. So when the Assyrians came down to him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, "Strike this people, I pray, with blindness." And he struck them with blindness according to the word of Elisha. Now Elisha said to them, "This is not the way, nor is this the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek." But he led them to Samaria. So it was, when they had come to Samaria, that Elisha said, "Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see." And the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw, and there they were inside Samaria. So the king of Israel saw them. He said to Elisha, "My father, shall I kill them? Shall I kill them?" And he answered, "You shall not kill them. Would you kill those whom you have taken captive with your sword or bow? Set food and water before them, that they may eat and drink and go to their master." Then he prepared a great feast for them. After they had ate and drank, he sent them away, and they went to their master. So the bands of Assyrian raiders came no more into the land of Israel. I just really like this story. I think it's I think there's a few things that we can pick up from this story that will help us in our daily walks in serving God. But I like this story for lots of reasons. But let's kind of start in the beginning here. The children of Israel were at war. It almost seems like it was a nuisance. The king of Syria had been sending a series of attacks on the children of Israel. And it wasn't like an all-out war. It was more like border skirmishes, maybe some kind of guerrilla fashion warfare. But it was actually, if we go back to 2 Kings chapter 5, in verses 1 and 2, we find that it was during one of these raids that the servant girl that was in Naaman's household was captured. So not only were the Syrians coming and killing people, but they were also taking people away and making slaves of them. And these kinds of attacks required an element of surprise. And this is where Elisha comes into the story, and where Elisha was creating problems for the king of Assyria. Because Elisha was being divinely informed of the king of Syria's secret battle plans, and the prophet then would make those plans known to the king of Israel before Assyria would attack, and the result was that some of these attacks was failure, that it wasn't working. And it wasn't working so much so that the king of Syria was mad about it, and he thought that he had a spy in his inner circle. And so he asked, tell me, who's for the king of Israel? Who is it that is telling the king of Israel our plans? Who's the spy? And I don't know how his servants knew this. It very well could have been that one of the servants here that's making mention of this is Naaman. I don't think that to be the case, but I suppose it's possible. Or maybe Naaman, in coming back, told the people of Elisha. I don't know, but one of the servants says, "Well, it's none of us. We're not spies. It's actually Elisha." Maybe he's just making an excuse so that they don't get killed. I don't know, but that was the message. It's not us, it's Elisha. And Elisha is telling the king of Israel the things that you say in secret. And so the king of Syria decides, "Well, I'm going to get rid of Elisha." And you know, previously he'd been sending these bands of raiders, but that's not what he does this time. He wants one man. That's all he wants. He just wants Elisha. And well, so what does he do? He sends what appears to be a massive army. Now, think for a minute of the silliness in that. On lots of levels. He's trying to get one person, and he sends a huge army. But why is he wanting that person? Well, he's wanting that person because that person is finding out about his plans. Well, don't you think that God would also reveal to Elisha the plan that the king of Syria has? Now, we're not told, but I wonder, did God tell Elisha, "Okay, well, we've riled up the king of Syria, now he's coming after you"? I don't know. It's possible, but it's also possible that God chooses not to tell him. But either way, the king decides to eliminate Elisha, thinking it would solve his problems, and so he sends this army after Elisha. They find out he's in Dothan, and so at night they go and surround the city of Dothan, and it looks like Elisha is going to be in a lot of trouble. Now I want you to put yourself in Elisha's servant's shoes. He certainly didn't know what was happening. And so he gets up early in the morning and he goes out. And Dothan is a city that is located in a plain, but it's surrounded by a number of large hills. To the south were the hills of Samaria. To the north was the mountain range, or the range of foothills that included Mount Carmel. And so here the servant, sort of in I don't know, like a bowl, so to speak. But he's in the valley, and he goes, and he looks up into the hills, and what does he see? But a giant army comes surround the city of Dothan. And so, of course, he runs back into Elisha to report what he has seen. And he asks what they should do. What could they do? What could Elisha and this servant do against this giant army? But the key verse to this story is in verse 16, and it's Elisha's answer. And it's this that most of my thoughts are going to be surrounded on. So Elisha answers to his servant, "Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Now remember, you're the servant. How ridiculous a statement does that sound? I mean, Dothan certainly wasn't a big city. Even if everyone in the city was a warrior, would they have been able to fight off this army? Probably not. So you could imagine that the servant was thinking, what on earth? Now, I don't know that we get the whole conversation between Elisha and his servant. But Elisha then basically tells him, don't panic. There's no reason to panic. Because Elisha knew that his servant couldn't see the whole picture. Sometimes I think we get in that situation where we can't see the forest for the trees, or in this case, we can't see God's working in our lives. But the servant of Elisha couldn't see that. And so Elisha prays that the eyes of his servants be opened. And so when God opened the eyes of the servants, he saw that the hills were not only full of the chariots and the horsemen of Syria, but they were also full of the chariots and horsemen of God. Now Elisha could have done... Elisha prays at this point. And Elisha could have prayed for lots of things. He could have prayed for that army of the Lord to destroy the army of the Syrians. Now there's other situations in the Bible where that is exactly what happened. But Elisha chose not to do that. And instead what Elisha chose to do was to strike them with blindness. And I think the parallel here is just great. His servant couldn't see the chariots, and so Elisha prays that the army then could not see. And so, in a word, it happened. They became blind, and Elisha says, "This isn't who you're looking for. This isn't the place. Follow me." And so willingly, the soldiers followed Elisha, who led them to the king of Israel in Samaria. Now, this is about 12 miles. Samaria from Dothan, 12 miles. I can imagine if I'm one of those soldiers, I'm thinking, I wonder where on earth we're going. Because it would have taken them some time to get from Dothan to Syria. And they present themselves to the king, and the king thought that this was the perfect opportunity. Can't you hear the excitement in his voice when he asks, in verse 21, when he asks Elisha, "My father, shall I kill them? Shall I kill them?" I mean, he's excited. All these bands of raiders have been coming, causing problems, taking away the people of the children of Israel. And now is his opportunity. And Elisha says, no, you're not going to do that. You're going to feed them and you're going to send them back ashamed. And so they went back to the king of Syria. And in the end, all of the attack stopped. So what is it in this story that you and I can learn? What things, as we read this, can we draw from? Well, the first thing is God knows the plans of our adversaries. God is all-knowing, which means God knows what Satan is up to. God knows what trials are coming our way. God knows those people who are here on earth working against us. God knows their plan. Turn with me to Psalm 37. In Psalm 37, and actually we're going to spend a good deal of time reading from the Psalm, but Psalm 37, verse 12, we're told, "The wicked plots against the just and gnashes at him with his teeth. The Lord laughs at him and sees that his day is coming." No matter what the plans that Satan has for us, no matter what wickedness he has set towards us, you know, God is still in control. God knows his plan, and in the end, God can do things for us to thwart those plans. The next thing is that, You know, well, before we go to that, I was thinking about some of the things I wanted to say, and I was thinking about Wednesday night, because this was when the lesson was, and you know, after we all got home from services Wednesday night, we got a video on Facebook, which was really great. And you know, I can remember when I was baptized. I think everything's going to be great, and it is. But in a way, you're kind of poking the bear, aren't you? You know, you're telling Satan, "I'm not with you anymore. I'm with God. I'm with Jesus." And so in some ways, you kind of get a little bit of a target on your back. And so God knows the plans of our adversary. He knows now that Satan's coming after us. And yet, regardless of how many people are coming after us, we are not outnumbered. No matter how outnumbered we look, we are never alone. You remember what Elijah said? In 1 Kings chapter 19, now, I don't know how much communication Elijah and Elisha had. It very well may be that Elisha knew of the problems Elijah had. But Elijah, in 1 Kings chapter 19, remember that he had just gotten rid of the 400 prophets of Baal, and he runs away to a cave because he's afraid. He's afraid because there's nobody on God's side. That's what he thought. There's nobody on God's side. It's just me. Remember what God tells him in 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 18. "Yet I have reserved 7,000 in Israel whose knees have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." You know, Elijah had just done something wonderful for God. He had just proven to lots of people that God is the God of the universe. And yet he's still afraid because he sees all of the people around him who are serving Baal. And in that moment, God reminds him that there's still a lot of people who are on my side. Psalm 3, verses 6 through 8. "I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me all around. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God. For you have struck all my enemies on the cheekbone. You have broken the teeth of the ungodly. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing is on your people." Psalm 139, 7 through 10. "Where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend into heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me." See, God is everywhere. The eyes of the Lord are in every place. You ever thought about what that means? There isn't any place that we can't go to get away from God. And that's both good and bad, isn't it? You know, if you've fallen away from God and sin, God is there. He knows what you're doing. But if you're like Elijah and you're alone, well, you're really not alone, because the eyes of the Lord are in every place. I don't know. I suppose it's true still today that God's armies are waiting to protect us. Psalm 34 and 7, "The angel of the Lord encamps around all those who fear him and deliver them." I suspect that that's probably still true today, that God protects us. In Joshua, the first chapter, Moses had just died. Joshua, in his very first speech, so to speak, to the children of Israel, they're all gathered together and he has some things to say to them. And in that, he says this in verse 9, "Have I not commanded you? Be strong and of good courage, and do not be afraid nor be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go." So the first thing that we can learn from the story of Elisha and the army is first that God knows the plans of our adversaries. The second is, no matter how outnumbered we may seem, God is always on our side and we are never alone. The third is that God can help us conquer any adversary. You know, he's got an advantage. First, he knows their plans. But then also, God is God. In Romans chapter 8, verse 31. What shall we say then to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? Just think about that. If God is on your side, it doesn't matter what is coming your direction. Philippians chapter 4, verse 13. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Let's turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 32. This is the second story I was going to tell you about. Remember that what we're looking at now is that God can help conquer our adversaries. God's on our side. It really doesn't matter what the circumstances are against us. God's in control. But in 2 Chronicles, I just really like this story too. Chapter 32. We've moved forward a little bit in time. Now we have the Assyrians, and the king of the Assyrians is Sennacherib. He's kind of gone through the world and has been kind of plundering the rest of the world. Now he's made his way to Jerusalem. And we're going to pick up the story in the middle, and we're going to look at the message that he sends to the children of Israel. So Sennacherib has just come from conquering other kingdoms, and now he's surrounded Jerusalem. Jerusalem is being besieged, and he sends his messenger into Jerusalem to talk to the people. Well, talk to the king, but he's really talking to the people. And this is the message that Sennacherib gives in verse 10. Thus says Sennacherib, king of Assyria, in what do you trust that you remain under siege in Jerusalem? Does not Hezekiah persuade you to give yourself over to die by famine and by thirst, saying, the Lord our God will deliver us from the hand of the king of Assyrians? Has not the same Hezekiah taken away his high places and his altars and commanded Judah and Jerusalem, saying, you shall not worship before, or you shall worship before one altar and burn incense on it? Do you not know that I and my fathers have done to all the peoples of other lands? Were the gods of the other nations of those lands in any way able to deliver their lands out of my hand? Who was there among all the gods of those nations that my fathers utterly destroyed that could deliver his people from my hand, that your God should be able to deliver you from my hand? Now therefore, do not let Hezekiah deceive you or persuade you like this, and do not believe him, for no god of any nation or kingdom was able to deliver his people from my hand or the hand of my fathers, much less will your God deliver you from my hand. On the way home from Kansas City yesterday, Paige and Reese and I were talking about the word pompous and what pompous means. This is what pompous means, isn't it? Here, the Assyrian king, Sennacherib, is, I mean, think about this message. His very first thing is, in whom do you trust? I know what Hezekiah is telling you. Hezekiah is telling you, trust in God. But then Sennacherib's got it wrong here. He says, well, didn't Hezekiah just tell you to cut down his high places? Well, yeah, Hezekiah did tell them to cut down the high places. The high places to the false gods, to the gods of the people who Sennacherib had conquered. But Sennacherib, he gets it wrong, but he's pretty proud here. And he says, all these other nations that we've conquered, they've had gods. They haven't been able to stand against us. Don't think that you're going to be any match for us because their gods weren't any matches for us either. But Hezekiah had already encouraged the people. And in verse 7, this is what Hezekiah says to the people. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid, nor be dismayed before the king of Assyria, nor before all the multitude that is with him, for there are more with us than with him. With him is an arm of flesh, but with us is the Lord our God, to help us and to fight our battles. And the people were strengthened by the words of Hezekiah, king of Judah. I wonder if Hezekiah knew the story of Elisha, because the words are so very similar. There's a whole lot of people with him, but there's more with us. He has the arm of flesh, but we have the Lord. So what happened? Did God strike the people with blindness? No, not this time. Because I think, because of Sennacherib's taunting, his lack of recognition that the God of Israel is the God of the universe. Let's pick up the story in verse 20. Now because of this, Hezekiah and the prophet Isaiah, the son of Amoz, prayed and cried out to heaven. Then the Lord sent an angel who cut down every mighty man of valor, leader and captain of the camp of the king of Assyria. So he returned shamefaced to his own land. And when he had gone into the temple of his God, some of his own officers, some of his own offspring, struck him down with the sword there. Thus the Lord saved Hezekiah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem from the hand of Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, and from the hand of all others, and guided them on every side. God will help you conquer your adversaries. The fourth and final thing that we can learn is to trust in God and He will deliver you. The story we just read tells us that too. You know, in the face of Sennacherib and this giant army, who really is saying, okay, you're going to trust in your God? Well, we're going to starve you. You're going to die of thirst. That's a pretty painful, slow, agonizing death. I'm not sure that anybody's going to be real thrilled to realize, well, we're going to run out of food and we're going to run out of water and then we'll eventually die. It's a pretty discouraging thing. So that's what they're faced with, but yet they trusted in God and God delivered them. Psalm 33, trust in God and He will deliver you. Psalm 33, 16 through 22. No king is saved by the multitude of an army. A mighty man is not delivered by great strength. The horse is a vain hope for safety. Neither shall it deliver any by its great strength. Behold, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear Him, on those who hope in His mercy, to deliver their soul from death and to keep them alive in famine. Our soul waits for the Lord. He is our help and our shield. For our heart shall rejoice in Him, because we have trusted in His holy name. Let your mercy, O Lord, be upon us, just as we hope in You. David here is writing, comparing the modern strengths to God. You're not going to be able to trust in an army or mighty men or horses. They're not going to deliver you. You know, if we were to be writing this psalm now, I don't know what we would put in there. That what things people look to save them, but it's not going to save you. What's going to save you is God. Wait for the Lord. Let Him be your help and your shield. Rejoice in His strength. Psalm 27, verses 1 through 3. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When the wicked came against me to eat up my flesh, my enemies and foes, they stumbled and fell. Though an army encamped against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war should ride against me, in this I will be confident. And finally, 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. Then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptation and to reserve the unjust for punishment in the day of the Lord. God, if you trust in Him, will deliver you. I really like this story. I like it because it reminds us that we're a pretty small part of the world. You know, you think about the city of Ozark. You think about the state of Missouri, the U.S., the world, we're pretty small in comparison to those large numbers. God's never really been one to work through large numbers, but there's a lot of people in the world who are against us. You know, I go to work and, you know, there's a whole bunch of people around me who don't want to serve God. And when I have interactions with those people, I think of a perfect example. We had a dinner party go to the dinner party, and here I'm the only one not drinking. Sometimes it takes a lot to be the one person to stand out. That's what Elisha was in this story. You know, here his servant is all afraid, and Elisha says, hang on, there's more with us than with him. And I always think about that when I'm in those situations where I'm the only one. And I bet you've come in those situations too when you're the only one. But you're not, because God is with you. If you haven't named God and Christ as your Savior, if you have not been baptized, if you've not had your sins washed away, you have an opportunity to do that. If you've fallen away, you also have an opportunity, not just now, but at any time. But at this moment, think about where you stand with God. If the world were to end, where would you go? If you're not certain that you would go to heaven, do what you must to make that right. Consider your soul as we stand and sing.
Number 396, the Red Songbook, our last song.